I'd like now to welcome Mary Ellen Hannibal. She's author of the new book, The Spine of the Continent, the most ambitious wildlife conservation project ever undertaken. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Hi, thank you.
So this is a wonderful book, wonderfully written, completely accessible to anybody who might pick it up, even if you're not particularly into wildlife or biology or conservation. Let's talk first about the term, the spine of the continent. That comes from, I think you said, a Blackfeet Indian concept. What does it mean?
Well, it's really interesting, the name, the spine of the continent. It refers in my book to this effort that is being undertaken by a lot of little nonprofits to sort of join hands across their work ambitions and try to coordinate their work to create linked landscapes all the way down the Rockies. But when I really dug into trying to find the origin of the term, and I had some historians helping me, we really could never locate the precise time when the spine of the continent began to be used as a way to describe the Rocky Mountains. And the Mistakis, which is the Blackfeet Indians that are up still today in Canada and Montana, had a term for the Rocky Mountains that they still use called the backbone of the world. So this term, the backbone of the world, is really the origin of the term, the spine of the continent. But when that kind of got changed, we couldn't really ever say. But there was terminology. It's really interesting. When the gold rush was going on, the Rockies were referred to as Uncle Sam's backbone because all of the resources coming from the gold were helping to keep the nation going and that kind of thing. But the thing about the spine of the continent, for my purposes, is that this is what describes this. If you look at a map of North America, you'll see that almost half of the entire continent is mountainous. And it is, a lot of it is Rocky Mountains, although it merges into other mountain ranges. And this is the pathway that the very first plants and animals and people that came to North America, this is the pathway taken from over the Bering Strait. There was a second pulse of animals that came back up from South America, but several times plants and animals and people came down and settled into what's now North America through this route. And today, it's still a wildlife sort of highway. It's how plants and animals move to do their thing, to interbreed with others of their kind, and to disperse and to just keep nature going. And there's still a lot of wilderness along the Rocky Mountains.
There's so much that's interesting about this idea of the spine of the continent. First of all, I love that Native American people understood what we would think of as, in visual terms, as a map, as a backbone. And as you write, the word spine also includes the concept of a kind of nerve and blood flow flowing through and almost making the continent seem literally like a body, where if those things aren't connected, in other words, if there's not this flow going up and down this highway or this pathway, things start to go terribly wrong.
Well, you're describing it so well. That's exactly it. And actually, even down the Rocky Mountains also sorts the Continental Divide, which is, of course, the main waterway, especially for us in the West, but for really literally half the continent. So it is a life's blood. And, you know, the Native American kind of cosmology or ecophosophy or whatever it's called, their concept is so sophisticated. And what's one thing that's very fascinating is that conservation biology and science is quantifying now concepts that really Native Americans have framed for many centuries. And so not only does the spine, you know, have this body, holding a body up and being like a central nervous system, but it's time transcendent. And the Native American, a lot of the belief system has it that, you know, we're temporary inhabitants on this earth. And there's an appreciation of evolution, really, and evolutionary processes in that whole idea. And that's very important for us now, because when we sort of sever the connections between wildlife with our roadways and our development, it's not even only that we are preventing animals from moving from point A to point B. we're also breaking up evolutionary relationships that have, you know, taken, in some cases, millions of years to come about. So there's really also a time dimension to keeping this landscape together.
There are a number of concepts that it's important to understand together, and that's one thing that your book does very beautifully, and one of them is the concept of islands. Islands, it turns out, aren't just in the water.
That's right. You know, it's the main islands. I learned about island biogeography, as it is called in sciences, by the writing my previous book, which is called Evidence of Evolution, over at the California Academy of Sciences. But I was trying to really understand Darwin. And Darwin really developed his whole concept of natural selection based on the Galapagos and on his observation that there were plants and animals in this one place, the Galapagos, that were related but not the same as plants and animals on the Ecuadorian coast. And he and Alfred Russel Wallace and many other people started thinking about, well, how did plants and animals get to where they are, and why are they similar yet different in some places? And then started to really put together the relationships between populations. So then in the 50s and 60s in the U.S., E.O. Wilson, who we all know and, you know, love who he is and what he stands for, he and a mathematician, Robert MacArthur, developed this theory of island biogeography, in which they counted up and made an analysis that the smaller an island, the more quickly plants and animals on it would go extinct. And then they also made the comment that human development was making islands out of even places that had once been, you know, large continuous swaths of nature, and that this was going to be very important for conservation to have this concept of having to try to start connecting these different places.
Now, when you have an island, the reason that species go extinct when the island is too small is because there is insufficient genetic diversity. Why is diversity so important within a species?
Well, to back up just a little bit, what happens with the extinction on small places is that there's sort of two life processes going on all the time. Immigration, which is newcomers coming to a population, and extinction. So extinction is a natural process by which populations die out. You can have a population die out without the whole species dying out. But on a farther, smaller away islands, you have relatively fewer newcomers coming to bring a new set of genes to the population on the island. This is very, very relevant to the spine of the continent, and one of the examples of what's trying to get accomplished here has to do with grizzly bears. So we have about 600 grizzly bears in Yellowstone National Park, and there's in the double digits thousands of them up in the wilderness of Canada. But between Yellowstone and that wilderness, which has all of those bears in it, there are some populations of bears, but they're separated by huge expanses of wilderness where there are no bears. So in order for those 600 or so bears in Yellowstone to stay viable, for the population to stay healthy, they need new genes. You know, it's like interbreeding between, you know, why we don't let brothers and sisters procreate and have children together, because it's this inbreeding depression happens, and it's one of the causes of extinction, because the progeny, the new offspring, aren't as healthy. So I like to think about those grizzly bears in Yellowstone and the grizzly bears up in Canada as kind of on either ends of a relay race. And that baton of new genetic viability has to be passed along up through Canada and down to Yellowstone to keep those bears healthy. And that's one of the real challenges to when we break up nature, because, you know, it's very difficult for people to live with grizzly bears. So where can we put them where they can still move across the landscape and get to new populations and create new lineages?
Somebody in your book wrote that more than half the Earth's terrestrial surface is now plowed, pastured, fertilized, irrigated, drained, fumigated, bulldozed, compacted, eroded, reconstructed, manured, mined, logged, or converted to new uses. And when that happens, that makes it hard or impossible for wildlife, first of all, to thrive in that area and to move around. And there's a lot of I mean, we human beings need metaphors to understand things like that. And one of the metaphors you use is a rug being cut up, a beautiful rug. But suddenly it's cut up. Is it still a rug? We're talking to Mary Ellen Hannibal about her book, The Spine of the Continent. So let's talk about the three C's, cores, carnivores, and corridors. And let's talk about one at a time. What are cores?
Well, a core is basically a place that is pretty much wilderness. And it doesn't have to be entirely wilderness. It can have some human uses on it. There can be some roadways, and there can be some, you know, recreation on it. There can be some hunting. But where there's a preponderance of the historical plants and animals who use that, have used that sort of landscape for a long time. So a core is really where nature is doing its thing pretty much uninhibited or unhampered by human impacts. Corridors are an idea to say we need to link the cores of wilderness we have with corridors. So we use this, the scientists use this word corridor to kind of describe the connecting rods between two different cores, but it doesn't have to necessarily, we think of corridors as kind of like, I don't know, a narrow little passageway. And it is any kind of passageway, but it can be broad, it can be small, it can be as simple as a highway overpass is the connectivity idea, or it can be a restored beaver population that creates much healthier wetlands. So the corridor concept kind of goes together with the connectivity, that what we need to do is connect these big core places of wilderness that we still have left so that they can continue to function.
And that animals can migrate seasonally and migrate as they need to. Now, going back just for a moment to the cores, to these areas where wildlife live basically free to do the things that they do and not hampered too much by human activity, there's a problem when these cores, even if they're wildlife reserves, are too small. So how do wildlife biologists determine, or whoever's doing the determining, what is big enough for a set of species, for an ecosystem to really function properly? 1 acre of land isn't going to support, for example, grizzly bears.
Right. Well, you know what? You're putting your finger exactly on something that if you wanted to go get your PhD in conservation right now, conservation biology, you could set yourself the task of determining exactly how much space one particular kind of species needed. So over that has been a big project of conservation biology in the last couple of decades, is trying to analyze exactly how much land is needed by what kinds of species and how much is a minimum population number to keep the species viable. And the answer really is different according to what species you're talking about. So, you know, you don't need that many top predators like grizzly bears or wolves to keep them viable, but you need huge spaces to keep them viable. You don't need huge spaces to keep something like beavers viable, and you also don't even need huge numbers of them either. It's sort of all different because all these creatures have different roles to play with each other. But it's sort of where we are right now is understanding that no matter what size of nature reserves that we may have, it's critical that they stay connected. Because if you connect them, even if it's sort of a smaller area for, say, grizzly bears to live in, and they can still make a passageway to another one, then you can help keep that population viable. So whatever the size is, it's the flow through that's really important. So this concept of connectivity actually even applies to our own backyards and to the fences that we put up in our own neighborhoods. And, you know, it's a problem sometimes, like, I have a friend who lives up in rural Sonoma here, and she was telling me that they have a real tick problem that they wouldn't have if there weren't so many deer fences up. And there's so many deer fences up, of course, people are trying to keep the deer from eating their roses, but then the deer don't flow through the landscape as freely as they would if there were no deer fences. And the ticks would be taken out. They would flow through, kind of, and instead they don't get to move, and they stay much more conscribed. So it's really, it just has so many impacts when we put up our fences and our borders for wildlife movement.
And, of course, that has implications on Lyme disease and all kinds of things. And I think one of the really important messages of your book is the ways in which so many different seemingly unrelated things are connected. And you make the point that we're always being asked to save the whales or save the wolves or save the trees or whatever. But we're not really told that if you save one, you're already, by doing that, saving a whole bunch of others at the same time.
Exactly. And, you know, it was like a light bulb that went off in my head because I was, you know, like we all do, you know, those of us who are nature lovers, I get all of these emails in my inbox, you know, save the wolves, give us $10 to help stop wolf slaughter. And, you know, frankly, I do give, you know, as much money as I can to a lot of different environmental causes, but I've really never pushed the button on, like, let me save those wolves in particular. But what I realized is, wow, you know, saving the wolves, saving single species really has these impacts that are so much broader. And I think this is a message we all need to understand a little bit better. I mean, I was working on this book for a long time before it really kind of drilled into my head that, you know, a wolf on the landscape in Montana is helping that landscape stay really vibrant and healthy. It's helping the waterways stay full of greenery and the water to be cleaner, full of more fish. It's helping the wolf there, is helping more bird species be there. And having a vibrant wilderness in Montana is helpful to me here in San Francisco because it's helping keep part of the earth breathing, cycling water in a clean and moderated way so the waterways, you know, snow melt doesn't go rushing down into the oceans too fast so we can capture water and use it. It all does come back to having a healthy suite of different kinds of plants and animals on the landscape.
When we talk, for example, about wolves, and wolves are an example of carnivores, the third C in Coors, Corridors, and Carnivores, these predators, like wolves and there are many others, are healthy for ecosystems not only because of what they eat, okay, they eat elk or whatever, but they also change the behavior of other animals in the ecosystem. What does this look like? Give us some examples.
Well, I think the best example is really the biggest example, and it's really the one that has been studied the most, and that is at Yellowstone. Yellowstone was extirpated is the word. They removed all wolves from Yellowstone in the, I think it was by the 1920s. And there was a real, you know, it was misguided, but nobody really understood that it was not a good thing to take all of the top predators off of the landscape. So it was, you know, they got rid of every last wolf in Yellowstone. Well, over the decades, the waterways in Yellowstone began to get degraded, and nobody really knew why, and there was, you know, a lot of different work on it. But so the Lamar River became barren of the cottonwood, mostly aspen, I guess, and willow on the Lamar, and the water became muddier. When floods came through, they would just come ripping down and puck up sediment, and there was fewer fish in the Lamar than had historically been there, fewer bird species. Beaver were gone from the waterways. And you might think that there might be more beaver when the wolves were gone, because wolves do eat beaver. It's not their choice, their favorite food, but they do eat beaver. So in the 90s, wolves were reintroduced to Yellowstone, and basically that was, you know, scientists saying we need the full complement of the historic animals that were on the ecosystem for it to function at its best. But it was kind of almost more of a theoretical idea that we need to bring back the wolf. So the wolves were reintroduced at Yellowstone, and they are a very hardy species and really reestablished themselves very quickly. And lo and behold, over the last 20 years, the waterways of Yellowstone have started to heal. And what a scientist named Joel Brown calls this is the ecology of fear. This is the behavior that you're referring to. And what he started to notice and other people started to notice is that when wolves are on the landscape, elk behave differently. So wolves don't really eat that many elk. You know, ranchers who have their cows eaten by wolves will be rolling their eyes at me for saying that, but it's true. They just don't take down that many ungulates, hooved animals. But elk behave differently when wolves are around. So without any wolves around, the elk were browsing the aspen on the banks of the Lamar all the way down to the ground, never giving those aspen time to grow back up. When the aspen disappeared from the banks of the Lamar, so the beaver went, because the beaver no longer had its food supply. Then the beaver leaves, and the beaver has all this huge ecological effect on an ecosystem, and many bird species and fish species also disappeared, all this cascade of effect. So when the wolves came back and the elk started to realize there were wolves around, this is how they behave. Instead of eating that aspen all the way down to the ground, every 2 minutes approximately, they take a look over their shoulder to see if there's a wolf on the landscape, and they keep moving. And just by kind of being nervous and watchful and keeping on the move, they do not browse that aspen all the way down to the ground, and the aspen has enough time to grow back up, bringing back vegetation that holds the banks of the river in place, creating a better place to sequester carbon, more microbes, more all this great stuff going on in the soil when you have deep roots going down into it, bringing back fish, birds, beaver, you name it. This is what scientists call trophic cascade. So trophic just means food, and cascade is a falling effect. And that's what happens. It's a very kind of stark diagram of how the food chain operates.
And that is a food chain that operates. You've given us one example, but it happens in virtually any ecosystem, including ocean ecosystems. We're talking, by the way, to Mary Ellen Hannibal, author of the book The Spine of the Continent. Now, we are in a period of mass extinction of species right now. How does this one differ from all the other mass extinctions that the Earth has gone through that we know about?
Well, it's a tremendous thing that's going on, and I don't really feel like we've put our hearts or our minds around it quite. So some scientists will say we're on the verge of a sixth mass extinction. Others will say we are in it. But basically, an extinction is measured by both the rate at which animals go extinct and the magnitude. So as I mentioned before, extinction is a natural process. If you didn't have extinction, then the branches on the tree of life would just extend outward and outward and outward, and nothing would ever change because there would be no room for new forms to come up. So it's a natural process, and the extinctions that we think of, like the Jurassic and the Ordovician, these are measured by huge die-offs of species. So scientists over here at Berkeley, Anthony Barnosky and Elizabeth Hadley and other scientists who are he's a paleontologist, so his work is what I really reference, because he said what's happening now is not exactly the same as what's gone on before, and he went about really analyzing, let's compare what's happening now to what has happened in the past. And basically, though, by making these very careful analyses, he shows that, unfortunately, we are very much on the verge of a sixth mass extinction. So there's a couple of things going on here that, you know, one is that it's human-caused. It's because of human impacts on the environment. It's due to habitat fragmentation, this breaking up of the landscape so that plants and animals cannot move to keep themselves going. And it is, of course, also due to the changing temperature and precipitation patterns that we call climate change. So there's that. And then the other element of this sixth mass extinction is that these large-bodied predators are going extinct at a faster rate. Now, wolves are not, they're not going extinct as a species. They're a very hardy species, but other large-bodied predators are going extinct, and this is this is like we're taking off this top layer of the food chain, replaced with just ourselves, and this is potentially has a really reverberating negative consequence through all of natural functioning. So it's kind of bad news. The good news is that this is the good news about the spine of the continent, is that we still have a lot of wilderness in this country. We still have a lot of room for connectivity, and we're just at a point where we really need to embrace where those connecting points are and not sever them without knowing what we're doing because we haven't thought about it, and really just make an effort to keep nature, sustain nature the way it is, and also tremendously fantastic restoration efforts. I mean, nature will come back. It may not always be the same as it was, but nature is very resilient, and just there's such fantastic stories of bringing back waterways and bringing back healthy landscapes. I just read in this issue of Oprah's magazine this fantastic story in Arizona of these ranches that have been restored, bringing back all of this greenery to what has been, desert and dry and not functioning for decades and decades. But through a lot of hard work, hard work that we can all join in and help with, we can bring nature back in many, many cases.
And I think what's so interesting is that if you put an overpass or an underpass around a highway, nature starts to use it immediately. I mean, migrating animals, they say, okay, well, we don't want to be roadkill, so we'll just go over or we'll just go under. And that works. I mean, they are very adaptive to what we do.
They really are. It's amazing. If you want to see some funny little videos on YouTube, just type in bighorn sheep and overpass. And in Arizona, they put some overpasses for bighorn sheep up. And those sheep start trotting over those overpasses even before they were officially launched. Now, this is not always the case. Sometimes, I wrote a piece for High Country News with and part of a series with another writer on the path of the pronghorn in Wyoming. And the pronghorn antelope, some populations, not all of them, take these ancient migration journeys every year. And they are kind of OCD, these pronghorns. So if you were to interrupt their flow on this pathway that they always take, they would not go to the right or to the left. They just stop. So pronghorn have to have under. They need fences that they will go under, and they will not go over anything. So there's different species needs, but by and large, all these brainiac scientists have figured out what each species needs and what they will use, and mostly they're very successful.
Going back to what you were saying before about some of the real dangers we're going through now with this mass extinction, a couple of things. First of all, there is this fragmentation of our landscape and these islands that are caused, these sort of land islands, and there's climate change. And those things are also related because climate change also causes more islands. How does that work?
Well, climate change, what climate change, sort of the biggest, broadest stroke impact on animals and plants is that it's changing the seasonality of when snow melts, when buds bloom. Nature has all of these interrelationships. So an example is the pine beetle infestation that has been plaguing the West. There's this symbiotic relationship between the Clark's nutcracker, which is a bird, and the pine nuts. And these pine cones are opened only by this particular bird. And when those pine nuts are destroyed by the pine beetle infestation, which is brought on by hotter, drier summers, then Clark's nutcracker can go extinct, is in danger of that. But because the pine nuts haven't been opened by anything, the grizzly bears that eat the pine nuts lose their food source. So there's this very close relationship between the pine nut, the bird, the Clark's nutcracker, and the grizzly bear. And so when you disrupt one piece of that, you disrupt all three pieces of it. And that's the kind of concept of what goes wrong with climate change. It's changing the timing and then the intensity of flooding and fires and temperature. But it's another real reason for preserving connectivity, because plants and animals are moving to the, all plants and animals are adapted to a certain temperature range and a certain level of precipitation every year. But temperature is really, you know, I mean, you and I can relate to that, right? We can't live where it's too hot, and we can't live where it's too cold. So we, as the temperature is getting hotter, these plants and animals are moving upslope on mountainsides and north. And so we need the connectivity to help them go where they will still be able to persist.
We're talking to Mary Ellen Hannibal about her book, The Spine of the Continent, the most ambitious wildlife conservation project ever undertaken. So one of the many reasons that I love this book is that it's wonderfully written, and there's a sense of all of these different people, these characters whom you meet and talk to, and one of them is Michael Soule, who is, I think, the inventor of conservation biology, or who coined that term. He has an unusual life and made some unusual choices. Who is he? Tell us about him.
Well, he's a really wonderful, singular man. He's in his mid-70s now, and he was Paul Ehrlich's first graduate student at Stanford back in the day. He's not that much younger than Paul Ehrlich. So Michael Soule turned his attention as a graduate student and then as a PhD on this theory of island biogeography, and he started to study this idea of islands and extinction. And so did a lot of other people at the same time. He's certainly not the only person who kind of invented conservation biology, but he has a knack for really sort of standing up and saying, this is what we've got to do. So he organized the very first conservation biology meetings. He said, we're going to call this discipline conservation biology. And if you can think of medicine itself as being kind of invented out of science at some point, he's like, this is like a medicine. This is like, we have to become doctors for nature now. And that's what he started conservation biology to really do. And lots of other people, Paul Ehrlich, E.O. Wilson, Jared Diamond, Dan Zimberloff, John Terborg. There's a lot of big names, Stuart Pym, a lot of fabulous, Thomas Lovejoy, incredible minds turn their attention to conservation biology. But it's really only like 25 years old. Michael also really authored the first textbook, so he really kind of made it into an official discipline. And then you allude to him as having made some interesting choices. So when he was in his 40s, he was very well known. He was very highly regarded. He has hundreds and hundreds of papers published in all of these, you know, journals, and he quit academia. Now, this is not something that you sort of do lightly. Academia is referred to quite often as a one-way revolving door. You leave it, you never go back, that you can never get back in. And Michael became the head of what was then the Los Angeles Zen Center. And, you know, he says, and he'll say it over and over again, that he was just burnt out and he didn't like the politics of science anymore, and he just was, you know, feeling discouraged, and so he went down this other pathway. And it's really interesting to look back over his life, that was a long time ago now, and see the influences that kind of seeped in at that time into his worldview. He became friendly with Gary Snyder, the poet, who is very much of a Zen practitioner and a Buddhist, and he met Arnie Nass, who was a philosopher whose idea of deep ecology very much influenced Michael. He did go back to academia, and he'll tell you that his life fell apart basically at the Zen Center. His marriage broke up, and interestingly, his wife, who's a pediatrician, she really took to the Zen, and she's now an abbot. I'm going to forget the name of the monastery in Oregon, but she's really stayed with the Zen path. And he still meditates, but he doesn't really call himself a Buddhist. But he's an activist, and then he really influenced by, you know, trying to put together what he knew as a scientist and what he knew as a spiritual seeker. You know, and with this restlessness to really save nature, we can't just talk about it, he says, we've really got to do it. How are we going to do it? He said, well, what we need to do is connect up all the wild spaces. So let's start, you know, a movement, an effort, a nonprofit to get those wild spaces connected. And that's what he did. And he's really the author of the whole idea of the spine of the continent, with other significant help.
And let's get back in a moment to what has been accomplished and what has yet to be done, because that's very important. But I want to stay with Michael Soule for a second, because I think one of the things that's so interesting and so important about this whole issue is that it's not only figuring out what needs to be done, but looking at all the bureaucracies and all the political forces and all the ideologies and all the human impulses that stand in the way of getting these things done. And one of the things that he's working on is a study of the seven deadly sins, which in fact relates to this very issue.
Yeah, it's really, he's so fascinating. It's a really an amazing idea. So he's now working on a book about the seven deadly sins. And his theory is that the seven deadly sins evolved in brain functioning as human beings developed the ability to some of these amazing capacities that have contributed to our incredible dominance on this earth. Well, we got these huge attainments, one being the theory of mind. So the theory of mind is when we first started to be able to be talking to somebody or responding to another person, and we first started to be able to be aware of the effect what we were saying was having on another person, what that other person might be feeling. And then to change how we are presenting what we're saying or doing in some kind of relationship to what the other person is saying or doing. So this capacity for self-reflection and changing our behavior accordingly is this incredible, you know, move forward in the history of consciousness. But he says, you know, unfortunately, the seven deadly sins also evolved alongside these attainments. And he will say that the sins really boil down to pride, lust, envy, those are the really bad ones. And what they're all about is status seeking. We seek status in each other's eyes. Seeking status in each other's eyes leads us into huge consumption frenzy. We want to have bigger houses, bigger cars, better clothes. We want to dominate each other socially. And this, to him, is the cause of the world's woes. And if we would stop, if we would take this status seeking off the table, we could live sustainably.
Food for thought, ladies and gentlemen. It's very
I know it's a lot.
It is. It's very important because it comes down to thinking about how each of us is participating in this in one way or another, no matter how much we're trying to do the right thing. But let's go to the Spine of the Continent initiative. Have any wildlife corridors actually really been protected yet for any species or for groups of species?
Well, you know, there's been a lot of when I really tried to put my mind around what has this initiative really accomplished, I would have to say that what it has most accomplished is getting this concept actually of connectivity out there. There are places where very special pieces of land between wild areas have been protected. There have been many, many wildlife crossings put up. There's been protections put on species like jaguar. Any endangered species protection basically is a victory for the spine of the continent. But in terms of legislation and real protection that can be enforced, the only protected animal movement today is the Path of the Pronghorn in Wyoming. And I really went into some detail on investigating how did this happen and what's at issue here. So one of the victories of the Spine of the Continent is getting through this idea of connectivity, and it has been taken up very fully by the federal government and by the states. So, but the federal government operates pretty separately from the states quite often, and in the West particularly with a fair amount of friction. So our Secretary of the Interior, Salazar, has directed, and in the last year or two, he has had these landscape conservation cooperatives be established across the United States and across our boundaries. So the one that I have looked most closely into is the one in the Great Northern. And so it's this ecoregion that crosses boundaries, state boundaries, all sorts of jurisdictions. And the charge for the Great Northern is to coordinate all of the efforts of all of those different people and places and hold hands across borders. And there's a wonderful woman, Yvette Converse, who directs that. And I think she's doing a great job. So that's a federal initiative. Then on the state level, there's the Western Governors Association, which has a Wildlife Habitat Council, and they have a connectivity initiative. And they are coordinating state efforts to get connectivity sustained. The Western states feel very keenly about wildlife because they love wildlife. We love our wildlife, but also it is a huge source of income to the Western states. But, you know, this impasse between the feds and the state, which has very deep historical causes, is something that prevents actual protection in a legislative way. So the path of the pronghorn was something that is, it's, to me, it is absolutely a way forward and a way to get this really done, to get connectivity really put on the ground. So Joel and Kim Berger, they're divorced now, but they were married then, were scientists who noticed that these animals were being killed by lots more traffic in this very high gas and oil drilling region, went to the Bridger National Forest forest supervisor, Niffy Hamilton, she's retired now, and said, let's make the Pass of the Pronghorn the first national corridor. Wyoming had the first national parks and the first national monuments. Let's be the first to have a national corridor. So Niffy Hamilton thought this was a really good idea, and she went to the Senate and she went to Washington. But she couldn't get Washington interested in it, so she came back home and worked on it on the state level. So she worked she really reached out to all of these different jurisdictions, the Bureau of Land Management, the counties, the towns, and the Bergers also helped really get nonprofits in on it. And they went around and did, you know, brown bag lunches to people who lived along the path of the pronghorn and said, don't you want to help protect this ancient migration pathway of this animal? It's right in your backyard. People didn't even know that they were living on the path of the pronghorn. And they just really got this grassroots buy-in from all sorts of different people to protect the path of the pronghorn. And Niffy Hamilton was successful in getting it protected by forest regulations. What's easy about the path of the pronghorn is that it is something you can draw on a map pretty easily with a pencil, because they follow the same route every year. It's a little harder to identify where should those corridors, where should the connectivity be protected. But I feel very strongly that this is what we all have to do, like where we live and in the places that we love. Get involved, figure out where are plants and animals best able to move right now. What's happening between Sonoma County and San Francisco County? Where are the migratory pathways? Where do those deer need to go? What's going on? What are the places of land that we should try to get protected first? And then it has to be done in a grassroots manner, because there's so many different interest groups in any place on the earth right now. We just have so many people in so many jurisdictions that we really have to sit down together. But the first thing comes with identifying the places on the landscape that are important.
Right.
And not to, you know, go on too much, but this is something that is really it's easier to do on roadways. There's a wonderful effort in Canada called Roadwatch in the Pass, where it's a citizen science initiative. I think it's completed now, where regular people would take pictures with their iPhones or just even report in to a telephone or a website when they saw roadkill and where. And So then these nonprofits in the area and the government in the area were able to put together where these pinch points along different roadways were, and that can help determine where to put overpasses. So that's an example of really being able to locate where are animals moving, where do we need to protect them.
It seems like all of this is a race against time. I mean, unlike any other issue, we can't make deals with nature. We can't make compromises. What is your sense of what needs to happen and the timeline in which it needs to happen?
I think we really need to just change the discussion around this in a lot of ways. You know, in the West in particular, there will be, for example, on the wolf issue, you'll have ranchers and hunters saying, we don't want wolves because of X, Y, Z. What I like to say, if I was a rancher, I wouldn't worry, even though it's horrible to lose cows to wolf predation and it can be costly, I would worry about losing the whole ranch, because that's what's going to happen if you have a degraded landscape and a huge weather event comes through. Fire and floods are going to really destroy degraded nature much more quickly than it destroys nature that is resilient. And I think as taxpayers, in fact, we should all be putting this into our minds, because, you know, look at Hurricane Katrina and how many billions of dollars it took to bring that back to some kind of functioning that's, you know, arguably not even there yet. We do not have limited funds to restore every place that's going to be destroyed by terrible weather events that come down the pike with climate change. We can save ourselves a lot of money by requiring that our landscapes be healthy. And I think that we need to change our minds around these jurisdictions and remember that we are really in this together, and what happens over there impacts what happens here.
Mary Ellen Hannibal is author of the book, The Spine of the Continent, the most ambitious wildlife conservation project ever undertaken. Her website is maryellenhannibal.com. Thank you so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
I am so pleased to be on your show. Thank you so much.